Nicolet Bank is honored to support all who strive to make communities great. Newsmakers is a production of Wisconsin Eye. To keep programs like this free and accessible to all, please consider a charitable gift to wisi.org/donate or text WISI to 44321. This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
School quality, student achievement, and money for schools will be important topics ahead of this fall's November 5th general election. While the presidential race often gets the most attention, state and local candidates have far more influence over the conditions that affect K-12 schools and the day-to-day lives of students and teachers. This episode of Newsmakers features a conversation about education issues on the campaign trail with Deputy State Superintendent of Schools, Tom McCarthy, and with former Republican Senator Luther Olson, who currently works as a liaison between the state and its network of CISAs. Guys, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
So I want to start with a question that allows you guys to reflect on your deep history of state education issues. You guys have been in these roles for a long time. What is one education issue that you wish voters had a better understanding of as we come into any kind of election?
I would think probably how important money is for schools. It seems like that voters are concerned that of their taxes more than anything else, which they should be, but realizing how important funds are for schools, and probably the biggest thing now is we have declining enrollments. It costs more per student than it did before, and so we fund on a per capita basis, but in reality that cost goes up. So everybody says, well, you know, you have less kids, you don't need as much money. But unfortunately, that's not quite the case.
Tom, what about you?
He took my answer, so I'm going to sort of build off of it a little bit and just say how important the localized conversations are around how resources are effectively utilized in schools and about how much of that is in the hands of their local school board and their local state candidates for office. You know, the legislature sets the amounts, and then their local school board lives within those parameters unless they choose to use the tools at their disposal, referenda or another means, to try to support their local schools. So the majority of the conversation while we think about statewide politics that is driving the decisions at the local school level are really contained in their own neighborhoods. The people they likely know the most have the most control.
So let's narrow that question and focus on state legislative candidates for just a minute. What education issue do you think those particular candidates should be focused on most this cycle? Luther, you want to start again?
Sure. I guess when we talk about funding, and because that's the big one, it isn't so much how much state aid they get, it's what are the revenue limits, because schools get money from local taxpayers, the state, some federal money and things like that, but we've seen in the past where the state has given more money to schools, but they couldn't spend it. So it amounted to property tax relief, and which is like, oh, we brag that we gave them more school money, but they can't spend it, so it does them no good. So I think the key here is the revenue limits and increasing that with inflation and things like that. That I think if they concentrate on that, it will be much better for schools.
Tom?
We'll find something to disagree about soon, I promise. But I would say the one and two, which can go either direction in my eyes, are revenue limit authority, spendable money, and resources for special education. The state has an abysmal reimbursement rate for special education. It has marginally moved over the last decade and a half as costs have increased. So that is like trying to balance your home budget with no increase in your wages, and it is a brutal impact that school districts deal with by cutting back general education resources because those special education guarantees are legally required.
So Democratic candidates are positioning themselves to try to retake control of the assembly this fall. Republicans have been in charge of both houses for 15 years. Tom, this one's for you. If the Democrats gain control of the Assembly, what types of legislation would they pass or could they pass? Do you think that they could that would work well with Superintendent Jill Underley's agenda and that would also be amenable to Governor Tony Evers?
I think in that schema, what we are attempting to do is to try to assist schools in providing local flexibilities around a handful of really critical issues. You heard Luther and I talk about the funding aspects, so drag those into that conversation. And then I think the other two that we have not explored fully are ways in which we can help districts focus on literacy and school improvement areas and school mental health needs. And I mean that from a not just a programmatic staff or a standpoint, but also a staffing standpoint. And I think a lot of that in the mental health space requires us to think about how we're being smart about not recreating systems in schools, but facilitating an ecosystem of mental health that can be co-located in schools.
And just to follow up, you talked about special education funding before.
Yes.
That is something that teachers bring up all the time on the ground. Would there be, what is the solution, or what if states are, school districts are expecting a certain amount to come into them for this, it hasn't been, what is the solution on that, or what's the roadblock to funding of increasing those reimbursement rates?
You know, I think the solution is we have the resources, we need the courage. I don't fully understand why it is not readily apparent in people's minds that reimbursing schools 30 cents on the dollar for an operation they're required to do is impactful in more ways than just serving kids with disabilities or experiencing disabilities. So understanding that, and again, tying back to the first point, that localized question of what does this do for my district? In most districts, what they're doing is they're taking money out of their general budget and they're plowing it into special education budgets. And then compound that with the fact that you have a low wage challenge where our workforce in the education space is in competition with other workforces that are in crisis. We can't staff those. That reimbursement rate problem leads for less stable budgets, which means it's really challenging to convince someone, hey, come work here in a school district doing this work. It becomes sort of a moral cause. And more people are looking at the instability of that workforce in schools and saying, I'm not willing to give you the moral cause if you're going to pay me $12.50 to be an aide or a paraprofessional in a classroom where my primary focus is special education.
Luther, you sit on the other party. So from a Republican perspective, what are the pros and cons if the Democrats take over the Assembly? Can you read the tea leaves for me from your side of the fence?
Yeah, I think Tom is right. Everybody promises more money for schools, and especially the special ed arena, which is vitally important. We don't fund that like we should. The thing that's interesting, and Republicans know that, is special ed gets its money because it's mandated that those services be provided. So where do they get the money if it doesn't come from the state or the feds? They take it out of Fund 10, which is the money for regular ed. So they wind up taking money from one hand and giving it to another. So the regular ed kids don't get the services they need because they're funding special ed. The other thing that we talked about a little bit is mental health, which is not special ed. It's kids who have mental health issues. And I happen to be the president of NAMI Wisconsin, and we deal with that all the time. And in schools, there are more and more kiddos who have mental health issues, which is the state is sort of has given them money to do work for mental health, but not as much as they need, and it's a growing problem or issue. And so a bunch of money it needs to be spent there, because if you have a child who is not special needs but has mental illness, they got serious issues with learning and getting along with other kids, and it makes teaching really, really hard.
I think that was also reflected in the most recent youth risk behavior survey, which I think is administered every 2 years. Something like up to half of the state's teen girls, especially, struggling with anxiety, feelings of not being, kind of safe and competent in schools and feeling like you're in control of your emotions. Is there anything that you've seen other states do, or have there been any ideas bandied about how to get more mental health resources? Because there's there's only a certain number of counselors and mental health experts that can be that are licensed in the state. What's a solution, or what's been talked about in terms of getting more of those resources into schools?
I would say we can look at some neighboring states in the Midwest here that have taken the opportunity that the pandemic relief dollars provided states and thought about how to structure a statewide intervention system around mental health. And so I would think of Minnesota and Michigan as being really good examples. And what they do is they center on that idea that they're not going to have everything that every single district needs, but they can make some conditions available statewide strategically to make sure that all kids feel safe, like they belong, and that they have access as they sort of, as Luther mentioned, ratchet up the intervention of need. And when you do that and spend some resources in that way, you do start to see some overlapping patterns. I think the key that most states have found is unlocking Medicaid as a source. So there is a what's called the free care waiver rule, which allows states to say, hey, instead of just allowing kids who have a diagnosed disability to access Medicaid as a service prevention, we're going to open that up beyond that to cover some of these mental health issues. And then the state has less of a responsibility of chipping in that money, thereby allowing the funding of this to go a little easier. The other thing that those states have realized, and I kind of stressed it when I was talking in the previous question, is that schools cannot do this work alone. Like many states, Wisconsin has sort of divested in mental health. It's not an immediate thing. It's been going on since the 70s. But that means we're sort of fracked across counties and school districts and private providers. And when you can couple those systems together to use a focus on kiddos, young learners, it allows you to serve the whole family, the whole community a lot better, because you bring the school on board as a partner, but you don't stop at the school. That's the struggle that we face in Wisconsin, is we tend to stop at the school. As soon as we serve the learner, we think, hey, great, the problem's over, right? Oftentimes it stretches right back into the family, and then that learner comes back again and is re-identified. So if you move across it systemically, you build yourself, and I think the really good example state is Michigan, where you're building a holistic community intervention around mental health, and then you stop that cycle. You break that cycle of coming back, and it takes less humans to do that, right?
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about money, a couple more specific questions. The state has a budget surplus, and at the same time, we've got a lot more money flowing to public schools and also private programs that participate in the state voucher programs. Let's start with the budget surplus. Luther, do you think that a portion of that money should be preserved for schools and should be spent in some fashion on schools? And if so, how would you recommend that?
Yeah, I would hope that that's one of their priorities. I know that the big thing is a tax cut, which is a one-time deal if you cut them once. The problem is a lot of that is one-time money. It's in your banking account, the checking account for the state. And so if you make promises to give schools that money over time, because you just can't do it like the COVID money, which is there and it's going to be gone, and now what do we do? And so you have to figure out how much they have that's going to be continuing. So it seems like that money needs to be spent on one-time expenses, because they don't have it continuing. And if we wind up in a recession or whatever, which I unfortunately was on joint finance when that happened, all the stuff you want to spend, you don't get the revenue, and so you have to balance that. It's just too bad that they didn't find a way to use some of that money. And I can understand, probably because the feds dump so much COVID money into everything, it's like, well, there's a lot of money coming in, we'll just keep our powder dry. But now it's time to put it in the gun and spend it.
Tom, I predict that you are also in favor of some of that budget surplus going to schools. How would you best spend it, or what would be your top ideas for using that money?
I mean, I'm glad we're having this conversation situated in the idea of what COVID did for the finances in Wisconsin, because in reality, what the legislature did in that first biennial budget when the COVID money was coming through to schools is say, we don't have to fund you. We're going to let you spend your federal stimulus dollars as if they were state dollars. And that allowed the state to pile up a fairly large balance, right? So I would contend we would contend that the stimulus, the extra money that sits in the bank, was built by the stimulus money, and that should be primarily returned to schools in some fashion. I would say that a lot of this, I do tend to agree with Luther, can be targeted and dialed in to areas of greatest need, because I think what we all want in this situation is to be able to look at the investments that we make and say, that drove better outcomes for kids, right? That is the linkage that we need to continue to make and allow to happen. Sometimes that means requiring a little bit more specialization in what we're funding or showing and opening up the books and saying these are the types of things we want to do. But the pandemic relief dollars gave us a bit of that roadmap. We collected that data. So we know school districts are investing in their workforce, just like any other business right now. We know they're trying to grapple with mental health, and we know they are trying to address primary areas of learning loss. If we don't find a way to invest state revenue, all of those activities are going to shut off. I think the other really big area that the state needs to take a swing at is engagement. We've got a real attendance and truancy issue that is not unique to Wisconsin, but there are some roadmaps out there of how we can engage learners. We surveyed kids themselves, and they said, hey, what we would like is more career and technical education, hands-on experiential learning. That costs money. That costs staff. And so if we want to bring kids back and we want them to build tomorrow, we need to listen to them and invest in ways that give them that opportunity.
That's great. We're going to come back to pandemic recovery in just a minute, but I just want to address the fact that Governor Evers signed into law a boost for both public schools as well as a significant increase in the per pupil money that goes to private schools that participate in the state's voucher program. At the same time, Republicans have also made it easier for more students to receive a voucher, primarily by lifting the income limit so that more students qualify to participate. Luther, you're such a pro in school finance. How do you see the expansion of the voucher programs and then also more rural districts feeling the effects of some of their local private schools participating? You know, there's a real push here between people that want more choices for kids, but also local school districts saying, hey, you know, we lose these dollars, or these dollars went to a kid that was already on a private pay situation at a local private school. How do you see that tension playing out over time?
It's interesting because there's a lot of schools that have declining enrollments, just attrition or just not kids being born and going to school. And then on top of that, if you have a private school, and I know there's some that say, you know what, we're just not cutting it, so we need to be a voucher school, which brings us more money in, which then they take those students out of the public school and send them there. So it really exacerbates the problem with their funding. You're losing kids, and then they're leaking out the back door to a private school if you have one and they decide to be a choice school. So it really causes them some serious issues. And as I said before, it costs more. The fewer kids you have in a school, it costs more to educate them because you got so much fixed cost. You've got, everybody knows what fixed cost. So you just got those to divide them by fewer students.
Tom, I know the department is not exactly in favor of more money flowing to private schools. What's the feedback? I mean, there's no putting the genie back in the bottle. Choice programs are here to stay. We have a unique situation in this state because there's certainly the expansion of the Milwaukee program to more outstate districts has just changed the dynamic a little bit about where public funding is going. Where does the department see the long-term future of this, or how are they planning for more money going to private programs rather than public ones?
Yeah, I mean, I think the challenge is one of Luther's old colleagues once put it very bluntly, Representative Castell, we cannot fund two systems in the state of Wisconsin equally or fairly. And what has happened as the voucher program has expanded statewide and grown is that the number of students, and we have imperfect data, so I'm going to tell you some things that are built in what we know. The number of kids who are going to a private school has not changed. It's been a relatively flat line of enrollment. What has changed is the amount the state is paying has skyrocketed, right? We went from a small experiment in Milwaukee to a statewide program that continues to grow. And how we are choosing to pay for those students as they go has also changed. And it has brought us to the current future of now, which is there is a large share of funding the overall program that is predicated on property taxes because the deduction of the kid going right now happens in the local school finance calculus and sort of gets rolled over. So as bringing a full circle to that conversation of people who care about their property taxes, and I'm one of them, I own a house, I want to afford to live there. A lot of the costs that are going into my local school district, or a percentage of them is a fairer way to put it, are going to pay for the deductions that are happening in these choice programs. So I think there's this hidden conversation that's happening a lot right now as the program grows of, can the state afford this? And if it can afford this, are we going to continue to use this local property tax piece to chunk into that? And then finally, is that constitutional? If I'm paying my property tax dollars for a kid that is leaving my school district boundaries, which is how the voucher program works, and I look at the Constitution and there's a clause that says that my money needs to stay in my tax district, is that legal? I don't know. It sure doesn't feel like it if you read it clearly. But you know, I would also care that my property taxes are being inflated by a system that has no benefit to me inside the bounds of that district.
And certainly, just to put a pin in that one, there's certainly very strong feelings on the conservative side too about the benefits of choice and different dollar amounts that flow to different kids. We can address that in another show. Let's move on to gauging student progress. We have a big problem nationwide with kids still recovering from the pandemic. I know everything seems kind of normal to people now, but we have a lot of kids that missed a lot of schooling. And trying to gauge the progress of that recovery is already complicated for many reasons. This brings me to some recent changes to the state exam, the proficiency cut scores for the exam, which is technical, but essentially is where how we determine who's on track on grade level making sufficient progress. The state has renamed some of these levels in addition to adjusting the bars for proficiency. So for example, below basic is now approaching, and basic is called developing. Some people have said that this seems kind of just trying to put rose-colored glasses on. So can you talk about, A, the reason for making those changes, and B, I don't see any way that you could accurately gauge how kids are actually progressing from pre-pandemic times to now without having some consistent measurements. So how does the state expect parents and the public to gauge that in light of these recent changes you guys have made?
So let's take the easy one first. Let's go with the naming categories or the conventions. We're not the only state to make changes to better define and put less blame and shame into the names. You could call it rose-colored glasses, but if I have to explain to my kindergartner that she's below basic in a task, those words have a sting. They have a specific meaning. And you know, the department feels like there is value in being able to have a conversation that is growth-oriented or growth mindset-oriented. And so like many of our partner states across the nation, we have made changes to change those names. They're arbitrary to begin with, and they were arbitrary when they were decided. So we're going to stick on the side of kids on that and know that you know we're going to take some criticism from people who think that this whole thing that we're doing is all just a way to push down or hide the actual results, which takes to the results. As we change standards, we actually have to change the test. So one of the things that we had to take on in Dr. Underley's administration was how are we making changes to the test to reflect the standards that we have changed and modernized and upgraded. So what I would say to you when you're starting with comparisons, the hardest one and the one that feels furthest from the home is that the standards have changed. So we have to figure out how we're reassessing those standards. One of the benefits of that is that for the first time, we're going to have a reading breakout score inside of our forward exam, which we've never had before because, as I've mentioned already once today, literacy is a thing that this administration cares deeply about. But that does break, you are correct, our ability to really cleanly evaluate what one looks like to the other. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, the majority of time students take in the testing ecosystem is a localized test. So you've got these normative tests, these formative tests, often from a major product that are sending data home to parents. The summative test, the state test, is really done for accountability purposes, which back end into the report cards. And the report cards, we will make sure have the stability that those critical conversations can be able to have at the district level or with their communities to say this is where we stand. They're also more holistic, so they don't just account for that forward exam, they account for some of the other things that districts are doing to serve kids.
So do you think a parent could reasonably assess or look at the state and see how kids are doing before the pandemic until now, given the changes that have taken place over the years? Would the report cards actually reflect that progress over time?
I think they're an imperfect tool. I don't know of a perfect tool for a parent to pick up and say, okay, I'm just going to look at this really quickly and tell you exactly how my school is doing. We've engaged in this sort of oversimplification process for a long time to say, let's roll up a bunch of data and make some scientific calculations, and then hopefully that will amount to, I can look at my school and say it's 4 stars instead of, you know, 5 stars or 3 stars or 2 stars. I think that if you really want to have that conversation, it does require parents, caregivers to get their hands a little dirty and look at the system and figure that out. So this is my long way of saying, I don't think there's an easy way. I don't think there ever will be an easy button for how is my school or how is my kid doing.
I think one of the things that the people who use those tests and results the most are people who are buying houses into a community. They go there and look at it. But as we were talking, Tom was talking, we have changed our cut scores over time. I mean, originally, a few years ago, Wisconsin had really low cut scores, below everybody else. And NAEP says, you guys are too easy. Well, then we got sort of macho and says, we're going to raise them high. And so we raised them really high just because we thought that was the right thing to do. But now I think it's in the middle. It's sort of like the Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It's too hot, too cold, just right. I think we have it just right, I hope. But as in my years of being involved in education, we change this stuff every few years. And so if people are looking at what is the trend and what's going on, it's hard to compare, you know, 3 or 4 years ago to today. But I think most people who have kids in school have a feeling, is my kid learning? Am I happy with what's going on in my school? And so that's sort of what drives them to say, okay, Johnny, we see what you're doing. We see your grades. We know what's happening. Are you successful in school, and do you like it? And are you afraid to go or not? Those are things that really, to me, make a difference on what parents at that time think. And then once their kids are out of school, I'm not so sure how much they care.
Okay. Well, we're going to come back to pandemic recovery at some point in the future. But there's like just a few minutes left. And of course, we're going to try to talk about Milwaukee Public Schools and an update there. So the district is supposed to get 2 audits that have been ordered by the state. Can you talk about the status of that operational and instructional audit? What new information do we have coming? And, you know, this has been the financial challenges, the departure of the superintendent, finance chief, comptroller. There's a lot of concern over MPS right now. So can you tell us the state of the audits, Tom, and also what is the next step for the district, you know, being held to the deadlines that they've been ordered in the corrective action plan?
Yeah. I think I want to start just by saying that the department is engaged with MPS on at least weekly, but nearly daily basis. And we have very strongly shared values that we are trying to do our best to support the district as they serve kids. The status of the audits, you'd probably have to chat with the governor's office. Those were governor-indicated audits. I do know they have got a firm selected on the instructional or the operational side that they are looking to move forward with. But from our perspective, we are most concerned with making sure that the district can push through their task as they face, as you very well put, a turnover in a number of key positions that allow for them to submit information to us to verify that the money is going to the right places and that there's no spillover impact of what's happening in Milwaukee to the rest of the communities in the state. I would say also on top of that, that we care deeply about the future of that district, as goes Milwaukee, as goes the state, right? They care for a disproportionate share of the number of kids. So we need them to be healthy and successful if we want to be successful as a state. And that is why we are spending so much time with them to make sure that the system that gets put back together is better than the one that we found and that allows for them to just coast into the future and not have an issue like this build up and then happen again.
Are they hitting the most important deadlines that they need to hit for the department right now?
They are working on it on almost a daily basis with us. We've got eyes on the prior audit and the prior year's annual audit and then this coming September deadline of dates. I think at this point in time, it's a little too soon for me to be, you know, pounding on the table saying it's great, but we know there are some really good people on the ground and Milwaukee is hiring more people on an almost weekly basis to fill the vacancies in their finance team.
Luther, you've been around long enough to see many a proposal be discussed for changing the governance structure of MPS. Those get discussed a lot. They're certainly being talked about now, especially in Republican circles. Is any of that feasible, and would it be wise to change the governance structure of the district to change the way it operates or the way it's split up, who's in control? Is any of that worth exploring at this point, or do you think that we should just stay on the track that the district's on?
Well, I think we've got to get their finances figured out first. That's primary because, as Tom said, it affects other schools. But, you know, there's other ways to look at it. There's saying split it up, which is an issue. Have the governor, or excuse me, the DPI be in control of it. Have the mayor be in control of it. Lots of different things that some states and cities have done. I know some cities and school districts a few years ago had one of the universities take over the control. So I think we should be looking at that, but I don't see any silver bullet that's going to say, oh, we do this and everything will be fine. It really does break my heart that Milwaukee is having this problem, because they got enough problems and people don't have a good thoughts about MPS, and this just adds fuel to the fire.
That's about all the time we have today. I'd like to thank you both for being here, for coming on and talking about these complicated issues in a very short time frame. That's it for Newsmakers today. I'd like to thank our guests, Luther Olson, former state senator, and Tom McCarthy, deputy state superintendent, for being on the show today and talking about K-12 issues on the campaign trail. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Nicolet Bank is honored to support all who strive to make communities great. You have been watching a production of Wisconsin Eye, your unfiltered window into legislative deliberations and public policy programming, where our mission is to provide Wisconsinites an opportunity to access the legislative process and connect with conversations that inform our citizenry. Please consider supporting our mission, and thank you for watching. Wisconsin Eye, policy made public.